Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fraggle Byrne. Every week I speak to leading figures from the world of sustainability and explore the sustainability agenda in marketing and strategy, technology, innovation, investment and finance. We look at the latest thinking, what's working, and the future and evolution of the sustainability agenda. I'm very pleased today to welcome Rachel Dreskin to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. Rachel is the US Executive Director at Compassion in World Farming, an international organization working to improve farmed animal welfare. Its mission is to end factory farming and advance the well-being of farmed animals globally. As Executive Director, Rachel is leading Compassion USA's growing role in forging a more humane and sustainable food and farming system through measurable farmed animal welfare improvements and protein diversification. Rachel also serves as a board member of Global Animal Partnership. So thank you very much, Rachel, for joining me today on the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
Thank you for having me, Fergal.
So can you tell me a little bit about what you do? And I know you're based in America and the original organization was set up in the UK. Can you just talk a little bit about Compassion in World Farming, when it was set up and what the overall goals are?
Sure. Compassion in World Farming is a global farmed animal protection organization, and we are one of the few organizations that is squarely focused on farmed animal welfare. So we don't work on any other animal protection issues, really focus around farmed animal welfare, which is warrants a huge amount of focus. And the organization's been around for a while. We were established in the 1960s, so we celebrated our 50-year anniversary just a couple of years ago. And we're established by a dairy farmer out of the UK named Peter Roberts. And Peter was becoming concerned about the direction that animal agriculture was heading in, and set up the organization to do something about that because he saw that animal welfare was being compromised in our quest to become so-called more efficient in our food system. And at the beginning, in the early decades of the organization and our operations, we were very focused around getting legislative change pushed through in the UK and throughout the EU. So some of the work that the organization did in the early days was work to, for example, get farmed animals recognized as sentient beings in EU law. We also worked to get some of the worst practices in animal agriculture banned. For example, cages for laying hens, crates for pigs. But as the EU was growing, it became more and more difficult to get legislation pushed through. So we thought, how else can we achieve large-scale measurable change in the food industry? What else can we do in addition to getting more progressive legislation pushed through? And we decided that we could also go the route of working on corporate policy and partnering with and enabling large food companies to create policies and sourcing standards and practices for their businesses that would also have incredible change and impact. And the U.S. arm of the organization was founded about eight years ago. And the focus for the program in the U.S. is really around the working collaboratively with food companies, which we call our food business program, because we see this food business work as an enormous driver of change. And we see impact from this work much, much more quickly. And it can be used as a building block for further legislative change. And when you harness this growing consumer interest with widespread corporate policy, it lays the groundwork for that and really works in conjunction with the legislative piece.
I guess legislation is maybe a little bit easier to understand, and you can see the results of that over time. Can you talk a little bit about partnering with food companies? Because in many people's eyes, the food companies are at the heart of the problem.
Yes, and they're on one hand, at the heart of the problem, but on the other hand, they also have a tremendous opportunity to do good. And when we were first setting up shop here in the U.S., we really assessed the landscape and saw that there was a gap in the market, in the NGO community, that there we really needed to set out to not make these food companies feel like they were necessarily the problem, but they were, but allowing them to enable them to be able to use their influence and their size to for good. So we came in really with the goal of understanding the challenges that businesses are facing, and but also, of course, being continuously guided by what is best for the animals. So the kind of work that we do with food companies, and we work with, you know, very influential food companies, multinational food companies like Unilever and Tyson, Nestle, Subway, those types of companies. But we really seek to provide them with key insight into animal welfare issues, sit down with them, help them craft policies to address these key issues, put timelines on commitments to move towards better practices, connect them with the resources that they need in order to actually implement these changes, and also increasingly to help them connect the dots between animal welfare and other sustainability goals for their companies as well.
Right. And I mean, clearly there's tremendous momentum now amongst consumers in many dimensions of food, be it in terms of, you know, organic or where the food is sourced, many dimensions. And clearly it's moving quite fast. To what extent, and presumably this is a big lever, a big driver of behavior change or interest, at least from the large food companies. To what extent are they? Do you find that their attitudes here and the way they look at these questions are driven by almost, you know, yearly consumer trends? And to what extent are they able to look at broader trends and broader values, I guess, because, you know, animal welfare per se is may or may not be on the list of priorities of particular groups of consumers, but clearly it's a, you know, it's a moral, ethical issue as well.
Well, one thing that the consumers are really pushing for across the board is increased transparency from food companies. So that's something that every company is well aware of that. And when consumers are starting to ask companies now, we want to know what's going on in your supply chain. The days of consumers just trusting brands to make the decisions on behalf of them and their families, those days are in the past. Consumers want to know exactly where food comes from. They want to know how the animals in companies' supply chains are treated. And when they find out that the majority of animals, of laying hens, the majority of mother pigs are still kept in confinement, still kept in cages and crates, when they find out that broiler chickens are being bred so that they grow so big so quickly they have some trouble supporting their own weight, that's something that is increasingly out of alignment with consumer expectations. So even though, of course, we know when consumers go to the grocery store, they're making purchase decisions primarily based on taste, convenience, and affordability. But they also are increasingly care about these issues, and they want to make sure that brands are operating or making progress towards operating within the values and the expectations that they have for them. So it's tremendously powerful. I do think that in recent years, we've seen a lot of movement to get animals out of cages. In the U.S. and beyond the U.S., really globally, we have seen a tremendous number of companies move from cage systems for laying hens to cage-free systems. In the past few years alone, more than 200 major food companies have made that commitment. And I know that that is in large part due to consumers demanding transparency and sharing with companies that cage confinement is not something that they want to support with their dollars.
Right, right. Now, factory farming, you mentioned from the beginning. What is, broadly speaking, your definition of factory farming? And just to give some sense of it. And also the scale. I mean, you talked about over 50 years that you've been operating. And how prevalent is factory farming and how has it been growing?
So factory farming is a phrase that we use a lot, and it's really to describe this intensive animal agriculture systems. And those systems are where animals are kept indoors in intense confinement, where they do not have the opportunity to express natural behaviors. So the opposite to an intensive or factory farming operation would be an extensive system. And an extensive system would be where animals are not kept in confinement. They are able to spend time on pasture. They have access to shelter, but are able to be in a mixed rotational grazing system where it contributes to not only better welfare for the animals, but better soil health and a variety of other benefits. But factory farming, where the direction that we have gone in with animal agriculture is really quite prevalent and accounts for the majority of animal agriculture now, which is quite unfortunate. And it is without a doubt the largest source of cruelty on the planet. And 95% of animals, just to give an idea of the scale of the problem, in the U.S., 95% of animals that are raised for food are raised in what we're calling factory farms. So that accounts to more than 9 billion animals a year globally in the U.S. I'm sorry, in the U.S. And globally, there are about 70 billion land animals that are raised in these types of environments. And Fergal, that is not taking into account fish. So if we take fish into the picture, the number is in the trillions.
Right, right. It's shocking. What are some of the standards there and the labels and the ways people can identify, that animals have been looked after and some standards have been kept?
There are some meaningful higher welfare certifications that people can look for. And a few that in the U.S. that I'll call out are Global Animal Partnership, which has five different levels to it, five and five plus being the most extensive of the system. So kind of that system that I was describing a moment ago, where completely pasture-based rotational grazing systems, animals spend their entire lives on farm. At the one and two levels of the program, it is kind of more of an incremental step up from the conventional systems. Other animal welfare certifications are animal welfare approved, which is also largely pasture-based systems, and certified humane is another certification to look for as well. So those are certifications that look specifically at animal welfare. There are some certifications that are starting that do look a little bit more broadly at agriculture practices as well. One that I will mention that is in a pilot phase right now, but is quite exciting, which I happen to sit on the board of directors for, is the Regenerative Organic Certification. So that is one to look for in the future. But that is a new certification that is the goal is to provide solutions to some of the biggest social and ecological challenges right now. And it takes into account pasture-based animal welfare, fairness for farmers and people working in the agriculture system. And it also has robust requirements for soil health and land management as well. So it really has three pillars of focus: animal welfare, social, and soil health.
Right. Is organic a shorthand in some way? Does it reflect higher standards?
Organic, I think, should be looked at as a stepping stone to higher standards. It is a step, but it's not robust enough. Organic really does not take into account animal welfare, which is something people oftentimes will find surprising, that if you're buying an organic chicken breast in the store, you have the expectation that that chicken had a good quality of life. But certified organic animal products actually can be kept in intensive factory farming environments. So it's really not meaningful at all from an animal welfare standpoint. It's also not robust in those two other pillars as well, the social fairness and the soil health piece as well. So I do think there is some value to the organic certification, certainly for non-livestock products. But I do think that it's really important to accept that we can't stop there. Organic is not good enough. And one thing that the regenerative organic certification is doing is seeking to help create that pathway and that roadmap to companies and to farms that are certified organic, and helping them get to the next stage, get them to more of a regenerative farming system.
Right. Now, what is the scale of the problem here, Rachel? You talk about some of these certifications, certified humane and so forth. I mean, what percentage of meat would you say on the US market has got this kind of standard?
In the single digits, unfortunately, there is a very, very small percentage of animal products today in the U.S. that is being certified to one of these more meaningful third-party certification programs. So that's something that Compassion is seeking to do something about and advocate for the increased usage of these meaningful third-party certifications, because I know there are a lot of consumers who are very, very invested in this and will seek out those third-party certifications, but if it's not available at the stores that companies that consumers are shopping at, or at the restaurant chains that people are eating at, people are fairly limited right now because it's not widely utilized. So one of the things that we're doing when we're working with companies is to not only encourage them to move to higher welfare production systems, like move to better breeds of chickens to give animals more space, but we're also now asking food companies to utilize a higher welfare third-party certification to provide that assurance, one, to their customers that what they say they're doing is actually happening and there's accountability throughout their supply chain, but also really to increase that percentage of products that are certified to a higher welfare certification.
Right. Is it much better in Europe? I know you mentioned that some of the legislation there and the treatment of animals as sentient beings and so forth. Is it better? Do you have a rough sense of how things are in Europe?
In Europe and in the UK, companies and consumers have been, and investors, a variety of different stakeholder groups have been addressing animal welfare, farmed animal welfare, for a longer period of time. So in many ways, the UK in the EU is more advanced. Some of these practices that we are working really hard to move away from in the US, where there's no federal legislation in existence, a lot of these practices are just simply not allowed in EU law. But there's still a long way to go as well. There are more progressive corporate policies, but the something that's very interesting that's happening right now is, and I'm going to use a specific example, and the example uses cages for laying hens. So of course I've mentioned that that battery cages for laying hens are not legal in the UK and throughout the EU. So in response to this, the food industry has partially moved to cage-free, higher welfare systems, but part of the food industry in the UK and in the EU has moved to what's called enriched cages, which are cages that are slightly bigger. They have some types of enrichments for the animals in them. And by enrichments, I mean things like nest boxes for the laying hens to lay their eggs, and things that they can just engage with to express some level of natural behaviors. But the animals are still kept in cages. It's a slightly better cage, but it's still a cage. And in the U.S., we have kind of leapfrogged over that system. So animals were kept in conventional battery cages. Instead of working to pass, focus on getting new legislation passed or corporate policy put into place that moved to a better cage, we just sought to abolish all cages altogether. So I would say on one hand, the EU and the UK are a step ahead, but in some ways, the US, in large part due to corporate policy, are actually leapfrogging over some of these kind of intermediary systems that are more widely used in the UK and in the EU.
Right. Now, how big a factor is economics and costs here? I mean, the cost of food has fallen as a percentage of, you know, workers' pay and so forth, pretty dramatically over time. And presumably, some people are arguing that, you know, there's a trade-off, and, you know, to keep food cheap and so forth. Can you talk about what's at stake in terms of, you know, what kind of how companies will have different costs associated with achieving some of these standards?
Yes. So it's really interesting. When I started doing this work in the U.S. Several years ago, a lot of the conversation focused around the increased cost of moving to higher welfare production systems. And there is absolutely an increased cost with moving from cage-free systems, from cage systems to cage-free. There's an increased cost with moving from breeds of chickens that grow extremely big, extremely quickly, to a breed that is more robust but may grow a little bit less quickly. And it's very interesting, though, that with this increased awareness from consumers, increased demand for transparency, increased interest from the media, from investors, that companies are starting to think about this in a broader sense, thinking about the financial and economic challenges of converting supply chains in a broader sense. And by that, I mean, they're starting to say, we're not just looking at what is the cost of moving from a cage system to a cage-free system, but they're starting to say, what is the cost to my business if I don't move to a cage-free system? So there is enough going on around these food, around the food companies, that they understand now that not making this change is simply not a viable option for them and for the business moving forward. So the conversation then really becomes focused around, we know we need to evolve. We need to keep up with shifting consumer preferences. So let's just figure out how we do that. And there are some really interesting conversations going on with food companies now around that. And it's becoming a little bit more broad in the sense that we are thinking about their protein purchasing more holistically. So I'll give an example of the kind of conversations that we're having with food companies without naming any specific companies. But while we're looking at moving, say, from a supply chain that is conventional, intensive, factory-farmed meat chicken to a less intensive meat chicken supply chain with better breeds of chicken, more space, enrichment, all of those pieces. We are looking at how much of that company's supply chain that consists of chicken right now. How much of that are we going to convert to higher welfare chicken, which of course costs more? And then how much of that are we actually going to look at taking out or replacing with something else? Are there plant-based alternatives that can come into their protein portfolio that can help them rebalance what their overall protein portfolio looks like, which one can help address the economic challenges with moving to higher welfare supply chain, but also will tap into the increasing consumer interest and awareness around plant-based foods, and also can help contribute to companies, to other sustainability goals that a company may have, like a goal around reducing carbon emissions or reducing land and water usage in a supply chain.
Absolutely. I was going to talk about plant-based foods as such an important element in dealing with global warming and climate breakdown is reducing our meat intake. And particularly, I guess the US is a bit of an outlier in terms of meat consumption. Interesting to hear you say that. Do investors actually talk about things like animal welfare? That's quite an interesting idea.
Yeah, it is. So you asked about the UK and the EU earlier, and it is something that ESG investors in the UK and EU, they are starting to ask about. It is a little bit more immature here in the US, to be completely honest, but we are seeing more and more investor interest in this area. And there are reports, there's a report that's been around for about 6 years now that Compassion World Farming is a partner in, and it's an investor-focused report, which is called the Business Benchmark on Farmed Animal Welfare, that ranks the top global food companies on how well they are managing the risk associated with having animals in their supply chain. So it's interesting because, yes, investors care about animal welfare. Some do. Do the majority of them care? Are they making investment decisions based on just based on animal welfare? Not widely yet. But what some mainstream investors are looking at is a company appropriately managing the risk associated with having animals in their supply chain? And if they see that a company is not actively and appropriately managing that risk, they are using that then as an indicator of broader management competency or incompetency. So it can be a really important indicator.
That's interesting. Yes, yes. Now I'd like to talk about the regenerative agricultural, trends and movement and so forth. But just before that, your Compassion and World Farming, we've talked about the US, talked about Europe to some degree. what is the state of affairs in the Global South? I mean, I know in terms of context that it was interesting that you talk about the movement towards a plant-based diet, but that in general there's tremendous food waste within the food system. I mean, in Europe it tends to be consumer-driven, and I guess in the Global South more to do with issues in supply chains and production and so forth like that. But I'm just wondering, how are things there? They have different constraints, you know, very fast-growing populations, I guess lesser meat intake per se, but then growing very fast as well.
Right, right. So I often get asked this question because we are advocating for the reduced reliance on animal protein, but it is really important to keep in mind that in the U.S., we are consuming three times more meat per capita than the global average. We're consuming four times more beef than the global average. And are we advocating for the same level of reduction targets across the globe? No, we certainly are not. And in some parts of the world, a lot of people are struggling with malnutrition, and I think there are a lot of things that we can do to help alleviate that issue, which we do need to be cutting food waste. We need to be looking at on producing food that gives us a better calorie conversion. But it's important that we also recognize that some populations are not currently key players in the climate change game. So right now, just to clarify this piece, our focus on reducing meat consumption and production and diversifying protein sources is we're primarily or initially focused on countries that are disproportionately consuming resources and eating more meat. And those are countries like the US, the EU, Russia, and increasingly countries like China and India that are eating more and more meat. But also we need to look at, as you mentioned, there are some really important factors in moving towards a more sustainable food and farming system for everybody on the planet. And we need to look at waste and reducing food waste. That is a huge issue that has implications for animal welfare as well, because such a large portion of the food and the meat that we're producing gets thrown away. That is an area that, of course, if we seek to reduce that, would have positive benefits on people, the planet, animals across the board. But we also need to look at what are the types of food that we are prioritizing using our arable land for. We know that agriculture covers half of the usable land surface on the planet, and 80% of that is being used for factory farming, and that's both for the animals themselves that are being raised for their meat, milk, or eggs. That's also including the crops that are grown to be fed to factory farmed animals. And we lose so many of the calories in that conversion process. So for every 100 calories that are fed to animals in the form of human edible crops, we are only getting 17 to 30 calories back in the form of meat, milk, or eggs. So the kind of layers of waste that are going on in our system globally is quite striking, and it needs to be addressed at all of those different points.
Yes, yes. So much ground to cover here. I just also, you did mention, and I'm just wondering about the fish. And I mean, I've seen some pretty eye-boggling statistics about the number of, you know, wild-caught fish that are used to feed, I guess what are called underwater factory farms and you know, salmon farms and so forth. Is that something in your remit?
It is something, yes. We actually just launched a campaign called Rethink Fish, and that is looking at just that. It has been an area of animal agriculture that has been ignored. It's been on the back burner for far too long, and intensive fish farming is having devastating impacts on our oceans. It's having devastating impacts on the animals themselves. I think I mentioned earlier that the number of fish that are factory farmed is, we're estimating to be in the trillions, but it's hard to even get a more specific estimation than that because we are, unlike land animals, fish are not the number of fish that we are raising for human consumption or for fish meal for other fish is not measured by the animal, but it's instead just measured by the ton. So that is, this is becoming a increasingly becoming a big focus for compassion and world farming globally.
Yes, yes. Now, you have a program which sounds very interesting, and you touched on a little bit, Eat Plants for a Change. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I suppose in a kind of counterintuitive way, or you know, if we were eating a fraction of the meat, or if we really were moved to a plant-based diet, a lot of these problems would disappear.
Yes. That is exactly right. So the challenge is how do we get there? How do we dramatically reduce the number of animals that we're raising and that we are consuming? So the exciting program that we have launched at Compassion World Farming is our Friendly Food Alliance program, which we're also calling Eat Plants for a Change. And we established this program really because we took a cold, hard look at what's been happening in animal agriculture over the past 10 years. Because, Fergal, there's a lot to celebrate in regard to progress for farmed animals. We really have been seeing a level of unprecedented shifting in our supply chains. Over the past 5 years in the U.S., it's just amazing the number of companies who have been are moving away from intensive farming's practices. But we also need to recognize that looking at the last 10 years, we are set to benefit the lives of a billion animals through the work that we've done with food companies. But in that same period of time, 10 billion new animals have entered our food system. So we're set to benefit a billion, 10 billion more animals have entered the system. And that's something that, you know, for me, looking at those numbers, it was very clear that we can't kid ourselves that we are winning, that we're making progress fast enough. We certainly aren't. So it's not just enough to try to improve the lives of the animals in our food system today. We need to dramatically reduce the overall numbers. And we launched this program because we know that similar to the work that we've done with food companies around welfare improvements, we know we can leverage those partnerships and that work that we're doing to have discussions around diversifying protein sources as well. And as we've talked about food businesses, I believe very firmly that food companies can really push us forward in this. They have enormous impact on our food system, and a change in a purchasing policy can impact the lives of hundreds of millions of animals. It can remove hundreds of millions of animals from our supply chain. So that's the idea behind the Friendly Food Alliance and our Eat Plants for a Change work.
That's a great campaign, and I wish you the best with that. Can you talk about regenerative farming generally? You mentioned the regenerative organic certification framework. What is it about? It presumably stands in stark opposition to factory farming in many cases.
Yeah. Well, I'll describe what a regenerative farm, what an extensive farm would look like. And this may not be that different from what a lot of people think of. It's when you think of more traditional animal agriculture, when you see those drawings on the outside of the milk containers at the stores with the animals grazing outside on pasture, and pigs that are taking mud baths in the forests, and cows that are able to take dips into the ponds to cool off. Animals have access to shelter, but they are completely free also to exhibit all of the natural behaviors. It would be a mixed grazing system that contains both animals and crops. The soil is healthy and actually serves as a carbon sink, so it pulls carbon back into the soil. The animals spend their entire lives on the farm, so they don't have to go through the process of live transport. There's minimal waste from the farm. Any unused parts of the animals are used to create other products like pet products, or will go into compost. There are systems that can revitalize towns and result in higher paying jobs. And this, I know this can, I run the risk of sounding a little bit idealistic, and this, it sounds like it may be kind of an unachievable utopia, but these kinds of farms actually do exist. And the farm that I was thinking of as I was describing that is a farm called White Oak Pastures, which is in southeastern Georgia. And this is a 3,200 acre farm that has thousands of animals on it. So this isn't just a hypothetical dream. This is an example of a type of farm that does exist, that is commercially, is economically feasible. But I also want to note that one of the reasons why we are advocating for a dramatic reduction in the total number of animals is because that kind of farm that I described is not going to feed the world with our current diets. We simply don't have enough land or enough resources to do it. So that kind of system is part of our vision for what a more sustainable food and farming system looks like. But that will be a niche part of the market. It'll never be the mainstream. And the owner of that farm that I just described, White Oak Pastures, a man named Will Harris, who's really incredible. He's quite a visionary in this area. He has said that as well. This is a niche market. So in order to feed the world, we also need to couple that regenerative system with diversified protein production and a much heavier emphasis on plant-centric diets.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, presumably these Friendly Food Alliance and this regenerative organic certification are key parts of your ongoing work. Are there a couple of other things that you're working on over the next couple of years?
Yes. So we have big focuses. So the protein diversification, working with companies on that is a huge part of our program. And another part of that program, which I will call out, is also really looking at how does this diversified protein sourcing, how does that fit in with other sustainability goals for a company? We really need to look at the and understand and recognize how intersectional issues of animal welfare, environmentalism, public health, and social justice are, and really helping companies connect the dots between all of these areas, because we need to start moving away from compassionate farming has over the past 50 years really been known as an animal welfare organization or an animal protection organization. But we're moving outside of that and saying we're now animal welfare environmentalists, because we know that factory farms are one of the largest waterway polluters via manure lagoons and agricultural runoff. We know that with the increasing number of natural disasters that such as the hurricanes that are hitting that we're being impacted by, are flooding manure lagoons. That manure is then going into our soil, into our waterways. There's just large amount of toxic runoff from farms outside of that are creating dead zones in our ocean. We of course also know that 14.5% of global greenhouse gas emissions, according to the UN FAO, are due to animal agriculture. So we know that the work that we're doing to advocate for better production systems and more diversified protein sourcing impacts all of these different areas. And not only does it impact all of these areas, but we know that without a reduction in meat and dairy consumption by 2050, in the next 30 years or so, our diets alone are going to push us over the Paris Agreement's targets, thereby sparking catastrophic climate change. So it's really important for us as an organization to continue really connecting the dots between all of these pieces, both in our messaging, the way we're talking about these issues, but also very practically with how we're working with the food industry. So understanding that, you know, as we're working with some of these large companies on diversifying our protein sources, we know that we can connect these reduction targets, the number of animal reduction targets, with other targets, such as targets to reduce the number of greenhouse gas emissions. And companies are really stepping up when it comes to those kinds of sustainability targets. For example, Unilever has a goal to have their environmental footprint by 2030. Tyson just last week in their new sustainability report announced a goal to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions by 30% by 2030. So a big part of our program and our work moving forward is to really work to join up all of these issues to move us meaningfully more towards a more sustainable food and farming system and more ethical system.
Well, that's a fantastic vision, Rachel, and a number of very big challenges, and it's a big workload. And I wish you the very best of success with that. And thank you so much for talking to Sustainability Agenda today.
Thank you so much for having me, Fergal. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. Please sign up at the sustainabilityagenda.com website or on iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.